This is Stuart Allen speaking from the Chapel of the Open Book, Wilson Street, London. Continuing our studies in the prophecy of Jeremiah, I will ask you to open this prophecy at chapter 2. Last time we looked at the outline, the structural outline of this great prophecy, and we've now come to the member marked C. It's a very long section from chapter 2 to chapter 20. And the heading given there, prophecies addressed to Jews, hardly gives you a coverage of the whole thing, and it's very difficult to find one sentence that will. But we're concerned in this study with the first two messages given through Jeremiah. And they are chapter 2, verse 1 to 3, 5, and the second from chapter 3, verse 6 to chapter 6, and verse 30. So we've got quite a big section to look at tonight. Actually, the prophecy of Jeremiah revolves around 51 separate prophecies, introduced by the formula, the word of the Lord came, something like that, to Jeremiah. 51 of them. So you can see we could, if we looked at this prophecy very carefully, spend a very, very long time indeed on it. The section we're going to look at tonight, you will find, if you read it carefully, that it's very, there's a good deal of repetition about it. This makes quite hard reading, I found. And you ask yourself, first and foremost, you say, well, why is there all this repetition? We can be absolutely certain when God repeats a thing in His Word, it's absolutely necessary. When we remember the condition of the nation at this time, we know that Jeremiah's prophecy is dealing with the last period of Israel's kings, and the blackest period of all. If there ever was a time when this nation needed instruction and warning and reproof and correction, and if they heeded it, encouragement, it was now. And so God commands this man and gives him the message and makes him repeat over and over and over again. And of course it reminds us of someone in the New Testament that said a similar thing. To write the same things to me indeed isn't grievous. It's not boring. It isn't wearying. And for you it is safe. So of course there is a reason then why we get so much reiteration. It was so that this nation, especially the southern kingdom, the nation of Judah, should be without excuse. In one of the chapters in this section, God's going to say to her, you are more guilty than your northern kingdom, than your sister Israel. Because you've had the warning of what I've done to Israel. 100 years previously, God had allowed the 10-tribe kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, to go into captivity under Assyria. Judah had seen that happen with her very eyes, and why it happened. And yet, she hadn't learned the lesson. She'd gone on the same old way, disregarding God, sinning. And so God is saying that to them, you're more guilty in my sight than Israel. And so warning after warning comes through this man's message. Now, turning to chapter 1, it starts off with the formula, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, thus saith the Lord. All these men of God spoke in an assured and a certain way. Isn't that good to be able to say that? Thus saith the Lord. And I believe it's because so much ministry today doesn't have that note about it that people don't listen. Of course we mustn't be arrogant, and we've got no right to speak in any dogmatic way unless we've got the words of the Lord at the back of us. If we can say this is what God says, then we can speak with absolute assurance. And so this man, like many an Old Testament prophet, comes with absolute assurance and says, this is what the Lord is saying to you. Now listen, I remember thee, the kindness, the devotion of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, when thou wentest after me in the wilderness, in a land that was not sown. Again, we may find that the Old English of our Authorized Version stands a little in the way of getting the correct understanding. And again, I want to say to all who are listening to me, do try and read it as well as the Authorized Version. By no means put the Authorized Version on one side, but do read it in a good modern translation. There are quite a number. You can read the Revised Standard Version, or Moffat, or Rotherham. There's quite a number of good translations. Not perfect, mark you. There's no such thing as a perfect translation. All bear the marks of human frailty, because they're the works of man. But we're thankful to think these men have taken the trouble and take the immense labour, and it is an immense labour and an immense task, to try and render the original of God's Word into our English language. We ought to respect them, not to simply pull them to bits. Sometimes we have to disagree, of course, with some of their translations. But even so, we can see the effort that's been put behind it, and we ought to appreciate that. If you read the Revised Standard Version, this is what you'll get. Instead of the word kindness, you'll get the word devotion, and the love of thine espousals, your love as a bride. Your love as a bride. When you followed me in the wilderness, God is going back to the deliverance from Egypt. It was the Lord that led them out of Egypt. It was the Lord that led them to the wilderness, and they followed him. They followed the pillar of cloud by day, and the pillar of fire by night. Oh yes. And they're likened to a bride. Your love as a bride. Now, man may mix his metaphors, and very often does, but God never does. Nor does he mix symbols and types. Now, I don't want to be controversial, but I know quite a number of believers and expositors who assert that the church is both the body and the bride at one and the same time. Now, does the Bible teach that? It's the only thing that really matters. Does God mix these metaphors? If we go through the earthly channel through which the church teaching came, the Apostle Paul, do we find that he sometimes calls the church the bride, and in another context calls it the body? Well, the answer is no. He never does. And God does not mix, but uses these things with tremendous accuracy. And it's for every student to note this. Otherwise, they won't get truth. Now, when you've got the figure of a wife or a bride, and it matters not whether you're looking at the Old Testament or the New Testament, you'll find that the people of Israel are in the background, always. If someone says to me, well, the Epistle to the Ephesians teaches the church is the bride. I've heard that asserted from chapter 5 of Ephesians. Because we have the command to husbands and wives, and the apostle goes back to Adam and the first woman, Eve. And so they say, there it is, Eve is the type, she was the wife, she's the type of the church. But those that say these things evidently haven't followed the argument carefully of the apostles. What Paul actually says there is this: husbands, love your wives as your own body. He says, no man ever hated his own flesh. That isn't human to do that. Husbands, love your wives as yourselves, as your own body, as Christ loved the church, his body. Here you've got a complete argument. But if you say, husbands, love your wives as your own body, as Christ loved the church, the bride, the thing doesn't balance out. And Paul does not say that. He's merely going back to the beginning to enforce his argument as to the correct relationship between husbands and wives. Nowhere in the prison ministry of Paul does he assert that the church is the bride. And until we find that, then we have to distinguish what God has made to differ. Now let's trace this figure out in connection with the people of Israel, and we shall find we get a consistent line of teaching. Go back to the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 54, and verse 4. Fear not. And Isaiah is writing to the people of Israel and to the people of Judah, as the opening verses tell us in chapter 1. For thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame, for thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood any more, for thy Maker is thine husband. The Lord of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Verse 6, the Lord hath called thee as or like a woman, forsaken and grieved in spirit, and a wife of use, when thou wast refused, saith thy God. Come later on to chapter 62. This is a chapter of glory, a wonderful prophetic chapter looking at Israel when that nation is finally going to be saved, redeemed, restored, when she will be at last what God intends her to be. A marvellous chapter. But it says in verse 4, thou shalt no more be termed forsaken, neither shall thy land. There are those who spiritualize the Old Testament, but what are you going to say about the land? What's the spiritual equivalent of the land? Thy land shall not be any more termed desolate. Thou shalt be called Hephzibah, my delight is in her, and thy land Beulah, margin, married. You see, not only Israel is likened to be the wife, God's wife, but the land is married as well. Your land is married, for the Lord delighteth in thee, and thy land shall be married, for as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee, and as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. Let's go to the prophecy of Hosea. Come along to the first of the minor prophets. And to chapter 2 of Hosea. This is a long chapter, but it should be read, all of it, in this connection. Israel, in her unfaithfulness, is looked on by God as a wife that's been unfaithful and left her husband and gone after other lovers. You've got that figure coming again and again in these Old Testament prophecies, in Jeremiah and in these minor prophets. Verse 2, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. But God wanted that to be so, but because of her unfaithfulness, she was divorced. But we know in the end that God's going to reverse that. And you get that reversal in this same chapter. Verse 14, therefore, behold, I will allure her, and bring her into the wilderness, and speak comfortably unto her. Verse 16, and it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, margin, my husband, and shalt call me no more Bailey, my lord, my husband. Verse 19, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Now, here's an everlasting situation that's coming, not something temporary. I will betroth thee. Here's God preparing his bride, look, or his wife, and it's not the body of Christ. I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness. For this nation is going to be restored and saved, and in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. There it is. Very strong language. And now let's come back to the prophecy that we're studying, Jeremiah chapter 2, where we have the same figure all through this chapter. We'll look ahead a little bit. Chapter 2. And verse, actually I've missed my verse. The verse is, turn, O backsliding children, for I am married unto you. That's in chapter 3. I was giving you the wrong chapter number. I'm sorry. Chapter 3, verse 14. Turn, O backsliding children, saith the Lord, for I am married unto you. So whether Isaiah is giving the Lord's word, or Jeremiah, or Hosea, they all insist on this figure of a wife, or marriage, as the relationship with Israel and the Lord. Now, we can well see that when this nation went into apostasy, God could well use this figure and say, well, you're like a woman that's gone after other lovers. You've forgotten me. You've been unfaithful to me. And that's the consistent figure all through this section of Jeremiah's prophecy. He has some terrible things to say about this woman who played the harlot, who'd gone after other lovers. And who were the lovers? Well, they were the other nations. Egypt on the one hand, Assyria and Babylon on the other. Trying to court favours first from one, then the other, and completely rejecting God and completely leaving his way of truth. But you see, at the beginning God says, now I remember you. You started off so well when I took you out of Egypt. You were my bride and you followed me. You see, you were obedient. You followed me. And although we know that even at the very beginning they failed and there was 40 years wandering in the wilderness, how marvellous God's long-suffering and kindness is that he overlooks and blots out some of these things and doesn't bring them back to his remembrance. If that wasn't so, well, I think sometimes some of us might feel very discouraged. If we were dealing with a God that was always reminding us of our past failures, where should we be? But we're dealing with a gracious God who passes over and passes by the failures of his children. And the one who says in the end their sins and iniquities, I will remember no more. Well, if he's going to forget them, if he can forget them, well, I think his people can too, as long as they realize, of course, what a cost it's been. As long as they don't do it cheaply, I think they can do the same thing. Now, coming to chapter 2 then, of this prophecy, let's look down. I'll try and pick out one or two features of this section. Verse 9, wherefore God says, I will yet plead with you. But this isn't a pleading or a beseeching. This word is a legal word, and it means to contend in a court of law. This is stronger. God says, I'm going to contend with you, saith the Lord, and your children, and your children's children will I contend. For pass over the isles of Kittim. Kittim is Cyprus. Remember the geographical position, that's west of the land of Palestine and sea, and send unto Kedar, that's the eastern desert. What God is really saying, go from west to east, search the whole of that a long line of country, and consider diligently, and see if there be any such thing. Has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods but my people? Have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. God says, search around in the whole of the length of their known world and see if anybody behaved like you have. That's what he's saying to this nation. Verse 12, be astonished, and he calls for the heavens to note it. O heavens at this, and be horribly afraid, be shocked. Be ye very desolate, saith the Lord, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. Well, you don't need those figures translated, do you? You understand, of course, what that means. The figure of God, the supplier of water. Doesn't that bring you to the New Testament? Doesn't that bring you to the one who spoke of those who believed in him, never thirsting, and the water of life, oh yes indeed, and the Lord, the fountain, the origin of it all, and you can't find it anywhere else. This complete satisfaction for all thirst, for all longing, for all needs, you can only find it, God says, in myself. If you turn elsewhere, well, it's broken cisterns that hold no water at all, no satisfaction, certainly not thirst quenching. Now God says, these two things my people have done. And that was the cause, of course, of all their trouble. And then you've got down low in verse 16, the children of Noph, that's our modern Memphis, the capital of Lower Egypt, and Tahapanes, Tel Dapheni is the modern equivalent of that, have broken the crown of thy head. Hast thou not procured this unto thyself, in that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, which he led thee by the way? And now, what hast thou to do in the way of Egypt, to drink the waters of Sihor or the Nile? This is figurative language. God is saying, you're turning to Egypt for support. You're trying to drink the waters of Egypt. You've forsaken me, the fountain of true water. And you're turning to broken cisterns like Egypt for your water, on the one hand, and Assyria on the other. Or what hast thou to do in the way of Assyria to drink the waters of the river? And that's what they were doing all the way through. First you've got the kings leaning one way and leaning the other, but the whole thing, of course, proved utterly and absolutely fatal to them. For both Egypt and Assyria let them down and finally proved to be their greatest enemies. Verse 20, for of old time I have broken thy yoke, but the Revised Standard Version very different. For long ago you broke the yoke. That's better. God didn't break any yoke. They were doing all the breaking. They broke the yoke and burst the bands of covenant relationship, of course. And thou saidst, I will not transgress, but the margin says, I will not serve. I'm afraid you've got to do quite a considerable amount of adjustment in the translating to get what the prophet is actually saying. This is rebellion, friends, you see. They broke the yoke. They would not go God's way. They would not heed his covenant. They said to him, we won't serve you. That's the meaning. When upon every high hill and under every green tree thou hast wandered playing the harlot with their idolatry and their idolatrous groves and worship, which they literally set upon the hills of Palestine. Yet I had planted thee a noble vine. Now here's another figure which we find linked with the people of Israel. There are quite a number of trees that are linked with God's earthly people. The fig, the olive, the vine, the myrtle tree. All are used in the Bible as a picture of the nation of Israel. Let's turn back to Isaiah's prophecy. The fifth chapter this time. Now will I sing to my well-beloved the song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. And if you look at the context, you'll see the care that God took with this vine to make it fruitful. Verse 3, and now, O inhabitants of Judah, and men of Judah, Jerusalem, and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. Think of God talking like this. What could have been done to more to my vineyard than I have not done in it? What else could have been done? I did everything. Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. Well, who is this vineyard? They are, of course, the house of Israel and the house of Judah, as this chapter makes very clear. A vine, says the psalmist, hast thou brought out of Egypt. And God wanted this nation to be so fruitful for him. Did he not? He wanted them to be a channel that would take his light and his truth to the ends of the earth. They would have been a vine then, bearing fruit for the Lord. Of course, coming to the New Testament, perhaps you can understand now, and here again I remind you what I've just tried to point out, that the types and symbols are always kept consistently. It's to John's Gospel you have to go, and the ministry of the 12, for the Lord to say to 12 Jews, I am the true vine. Now they knew very well that they as the nation were the vine, but the Lord said, I'm the real one. That's the meaning of the word true. You're only the picture, you're only the type. Israel, the typical nation, always, in all these things. But I am the real vine. And then comes the wonderful lesson, you're only the branches of the vine. And if you don't stay put, that's the word abide in me, no fruit. In fact, if you divorce yourself from me, you're going to wither and you're going to die. So the great lesson of unity and keeping close to Christ is taught. And let us remember that that lesson is still enforced, and enforced even more possibly in the prison ministry of the Apostle Paul. For when he writes the church at Colossae and tells them to hold fast to the head. The figure changes, but the truth is just the same. Holding for the body to hold fast to the head is saying the same thing as the branches staying put in the vine, because he's both. He's both the vine and the head. It's the same person. And so we're dealing with a great lesson that's true for all time. If only God's people will keep close to him, in his will, in his way, all what isn't possible then. But supposing they don't, and remember, we're never dealing with a God that makes his people go his own way or keeps them against their will. If they choose to go the opposite way, well, they go. But what sad lessons have to be learned if that's so? And so this is what God is trying to tell his people. I wanted you to be like a fruitful vine. I wanted you to be the channel of blessing to the whole earth. I planted you a noble vine, God says, but at last you're bringing forth wild grapes. You're useless to me. Useless to me. As any gardener knows, if you take trouble over fruit and you don't get fruit or it doesn't produce what you want, well, you might just as well uproot it. Useless to you. And so, in this chapter 2, this is the figure that God now uses. Or he changes it, look, in verse 22, and says, for though thou wash thee with nitre, this is lye, this is the mineral alkali that they got from the soda lakes of Egypt, combined with oil, made a kind of a soap, though you wash yourself with lye or nitre, and take thee much soap, yet thine iniquity is marked before me, or you can't wash it away with soap and water, God said. No, indeed. It's still before me. How can you say, God said, I'm not polluted. I've not gone after Balaam. They were doing that all the time with their idolatrous groves. See the way in the valley. Know what thou hast done. And so on. Verse 27, saying to a stock, this is the Asherah, this is a fashion tree, which they actually worshipped, of course, together with their stone images, saying to a stock, thou art my father, and to a stone, thou hast brought me forth. For they have turned their back to me, God says, and not their face. And in the time of their trouble, they will say, arise and save us. Oh yes, they'll turn back to me, God says, when they get into a difficulty. But when things are going easy, they don't want me. That's been repeated a good many times, hasn't it? I wonder whether that's even been true in our own experience. Perhaps the times when we've been closest to the Lord is when we've been in trouble. When we've just had to cry to him, it's been the only help, the only thing we could do. And when things are going so easy, well, it's very easy to forget him, isn't it? And to go along, as it were, under our own strength. But all we might learn these lessons, because they are true for all time. In the time of their trouble, they will say, arise and save us. But God says, and he almost mocks them. He says, but where are thy gods that thou hast made? Ask them. You see, when you get into trouble, don't come to me. Go to your gods that you worship. Verse 29, wherefore will ye plead, will you complain against me, God says. You've all have transgressed against me. And so, we might go down this chapter, but we shall have to come to chapter 3, because I can only just give the general drift. Now, still keeping this figure of a wife, an unfaithful wife, look at verse 1. They say, if a man put away or divorce his wife, and she go from him, and become another man's, shall he return to her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers. Yet return again to me, saith the Lord. It's very difficult to know quite how to, apparently, to translate this passage. The Revised Standard Version puts it this way. Would you return to me? As though God isn't saying return to me, but you've played a part of an unfaithful wife with me. And are you now going to pretend to come back? Because often in pretense Israel did that. You see, I pointed out at the very beginning of this study, there had been a reformation in the reign of Josiah. There had been an outward sort of cleaning up of idolatry. And apparently it looked as though they were beginning to turn back to God, but of course God could see beneath the surface. It was only just a surface thing. That's what he's actually saying. It wasn't the real thing at all. While that man did his very best, and he was a great and godly king, of course, but you see, you can't legislate, you can't make people either believers or Christians' friends. Governments can't do that. You can't legislate like that. This is an affair of the heart. This is an affair of the will and of the faith. And those things are personal to each person. You can't command or make it so. Therefore, God said in verse 3, because of that, so often God had withheld the rain on the land, so their land didn't produce, their crops failed, their animals starved, and they went short of food. God had to do that in judgment to bring them to their senses. Verse 3, therefore the showers have been withdrawn, and there has been no latter rain. Thou hast a whore's forehead. What an extraordinary expression. But we would say in our modern language, you've been brazen-faced. And so they were. You couldn't touch them. They were so hard. They sort of shook their fist in God's face and didn't care. You've been brazen-faced. Thou refusest to be ashamed, God says. Verse 6. The Lord said also, and this comes to Jeremiah's second message. The first message ends with verse 5 of chapter 3. The second one. The Lord said also to me, in the days of Josiah, the king, hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? Sometimes we've got to take care with this as to whether Israel means the 10 tribes, as it does, as distinct from Judah, the southern kingdom, or whether it means the both of them together. Now the context here shows God is referring to the northern kingdom. Backsliding, the Hebrew says apostasy Israel, literally. This is the nation, the northern part of the kingdom, that had gone into apostasy and had been taken captive by Assyria nearly a century before. She has gone up upon every high mountain, upon under every tree, and there played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me, but she didn't do it. She returned not. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. So you see, it's quite obvious from the context that Israel means the northern kingdom. And God is now going to say that they had this warning. Judah had the warning of Israel and the judgment that came upon her, yet she didn't take it to heart. And so in verse 11, the Lord said to me, that backsliding Israel hath justified herself more than treacherous Judah. Just backsliding Israel hath shown herself less guilty than treacherous Judah. And although they were at this very moment when Jeremiah wrote and prophesied in Assyria, being enslaved by them, God sends this message, go and proclaim these things toward the north, to Assyria, and say, return, thou backsliding Israel, saith the Lord, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, saith the Lord, and I will not keep my anger forever. Only acknowledge your iniquity, your sin, that thou hast transgressed against the Lord thy God, and hast scattered the ways to the strangers under every green tree. Acknowledge your sin, come back, and you're dealing with a merciful God. Isn't God's long-suffering a wonderful thing? We've seen that again and again. Why didn't God blot this nation out entirely and produce some other plan for world blessing? After all, he's a God that could do anything. He's not tied to one way of carrying out his will. Why didn't he do that? Isn't it that he wanted to give an exhibition that he is just that, the God of intense long-suffering and mercy? That's his quality, all through the scriptures. And he's still the same God today. And so he says, turn, O backsliding children, for I am married unto you. And then the remnant, I will take one of a city, two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. And I will give you leaders, pastors, according to mine heart. Now we've got the comforting side when this happens. The restoration, anyway, of a faithful remnant. And we've found in other studies, that God always has that faithful remnant. Never are the times so black and the people fail so much there isn't anybody left at all. For if God allowed things to get to that stage, of course his plan would founder entirely. But that isn't so. And so there's still the ones and the twos God's going to deal with. And it'll come to pass, verse 16, when you'll be multiplied and increased in the land, that's these ones and twos that come back, the faithful ones, in those days, they shall say no more the ark of the covenant of the Lord, neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it. Why is that? Because it's this prophecy of all prophecies that talks about the better covenant, the new covenant. And do you remember that's one of the great points of the Epistle to the Hebrews? That better covenant that supersedes the old covenant of law, of which the ark was a symbol. That God said, that's never going to be remembered. That's going to pass away. Because although the law was holy, just, and good, as Paul wrote centuries later, nothing wrong with it. It was God's law, it was God's standard of righteousness. But it was weak on account of the flesh. It was weak because man's frailty and his sinful nature, he couldn't keep it. He couldn't rise to that standard. And so God said, I'll finish with it. And so you've got a new covenant coming in with this people. We're going to see that at the very center, the heart of this prophecy in chapter 31, 32, and 33. Verse 17, at that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it. Now we're coming to the glorious time when this nation is back in its place. This is the faithful remnant when they've increased in the land and they're usable. They've come under the new covenant blessings, and at last the nations are at last going to be gathered to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem. Neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil hearts. But in those days, the house of Judah shall walk with the house of Israel. They're going to be united. The prophecy of Ezekiel. Ezekiel was given a vision of two sticks, you remember. And God said one stick represents Israel, the 10 tribe kingdom. And the other stick represents Judah. Now you take, Ezekiel, those two sticks in your hand and hold them together and they'll become one. And they did. And that symbolically, we are told, means that God is going to unite what has temporarily been a divorce between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Of course, there are all sorts of theories. We hear about the lost 10 tribes and the British race being the descendants of these tribes. They're not lost friends. God knows exactly where they are. For there's coming a day when their descendants and the true descendants of Judah are going to be united. And God says, never shall they be divorced again. Never shall there be two nations separately again. There should be one nation in the land. That is one of the great burdens of Ezekiel's prophecy. But here they are together. The house of Judah shall walk with the house of Israel, and they shall come together out of the land of the north to the land that I've given for inheritance to your fathers. You must take that literally. That is the land which God gave to Abraham, from the river Nile right over to the river Euphrates. And so the command again in verse 22, return, you backsliding children, and I will heal your backslidings. Chapter 4. But God said, if you're going to return, verse 1, you must return to me. It's no good turning to anybody else. That's what verse 1 says. If thou wilt return, O Israel, saith the Lord, return unto me. And if thou wilt put away thine abominations out of my sight, then thou shalt not be removed, revised version. Not remove, as our authorized version puts it. You will not be removed. And if thou shalt swear, the Lord liveth in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness, then the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory. You see, I've rather changed a little bit. The revised version does that, and makes a good deal more sense of the context. Break up your fallow ground, and so on. Now, comes the warning of the nation of Babylon. This is the thing that God is holding over their head in judgment all the time. If you don't turn, I've told you what I'm going to do, God says, I'll forgive you. If you'll come back. I'll heal your backslidings. Although they've been terrible and great. But now supposing you don't, well I warned you, I'm going to raise up a nation. You've never seen the light before or since. They're a terrible nation. and they're going to enslave you. You're going to know what enslavement in the worst sense is. So, verse 5 starts this warning. Declare ye in Judah, and publish in Jerusalem, and say, Blow ye the trumpet in the land. Cry, gather together and say, Assemble yourselves, and let us go into the fortified cities, because the enemy is at hand, this is the nation, approaching. Set up the standard toward Zion, retire, revised version, flee for safety. Better, isn't it? Escape. Stay not, for God says, I'll bring evil from the north. Don't forget that the invader always came from the north into the land of Palestine, whether it was Assyria or Babylon. I will bring evil from the north and a great destruction. And then God likens this nation to various figures, a lion out of a thicket, out of his thicket. The destroyer of the Gentiles is on his way. Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. He is gone from his place to make thy land desolate. And so he did in the end. And thy cities shall be laid waste. So they were, including Jerusalem and the temple. Literally fulfilled, without an inhabitant. For this, gird you with sackcloth, lament and howl. For the fierce anger of the Lord is not turned from us. And then it's likened to the dry sirocco. You know the east wind that blows over that part from the hot desert and scorches everything up. Apparently it's a terrible experience when that happens. Verse 11. At that time it shall be said to this people and to Jerusalem, a dry wind of the high places in the wilderness toward the daughter of my people, not to fan nor to cleanse. Even a full wind from those places shall come up, not unto me, for me. Because it's part of God's judgment. God's going to use it for judgment. Now also I will give sentence against them. And he goes from verse 15, from Dan, that's right up in the north, if you look where Dan was stationed, right down to the bottom, to Ephraim, that's the whole land. Make ye mention, Revised Standard Version, warn the nations. Behold, publish against Jerusalem. Besiegers, not watchers, come from a far country, Babylon, and give out their voice against the cities of Judah, and so on. And then the prophet interjects with the tremendous reaction this had on him. It upset him, verse 19, he said, I'm pained at my very heart. A peculiar figure of the bowels being used, but we've seen before, that's often where you do feel peculiar, when you're in some stress or strain. You may remember what it's like to be in, perhaps going in for an important exam, or some moment of tension. That's exactly where you do feel it, down here. So these Old Testament prophets weren't quite so peculiar as it seems on the surface. But this man is upset when he sees what God has threatened to do to his own nation, whom he loves so well. He says, I'm pained at my very heart. And so on. And then he has a vision. And here I shall have to stop, but we must look at this next time. He actually goes back and uses the description of Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2, without form and void. But I beheld the earth, verse 23, and lo, it was tohu and bohu, without form and void, the very words used in Genesis. And the heavens, they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and so on. So here was something tremendous. Jeremiah had a vision of the earth as it was, without form and void. Why? Because God is going to say to him, now you see all that desolation? That is what's going to happen to this people. Something like that. So a terrible thing, is it not? That should have to happen to this covenant people. Well, I know perhaps some of this is rather depressing to have to read, but if we're going to give a study of this prophecy, we've got to note these things. On the other hand, we're going to see, of course, that all isn't judgment, all is not warning. There's so many gracious things that we're going to discover in Jeremiah's prophecy, especially when we come to the central section. Wonderful things God's going to say yet to this people, though he had to speak so hard and so harshly. It was the only thing to try and pull them up. Alas, they didn't learn it. They had to learn it the hard way, friends. Now, isn't that so human? Hasn't that been repeated many, many times? Sometimes God's people, even today, have to learn vital lessons the hard way, because they won't learn it the easy way. They won't learn it when God says, do this or don't do this. But they've got to go their own way and burn their own fingers, and then they start to learn that God means what he says, and it's true. Well, children often do that, don't they? They sometimes have to learn the hard way, and even us adults do. But how much more wise we should be if we didn't. If we always went in the way of truth and said to ourselves always, well, surely God knows best. And he's a God of love. He's not going to ask me to do anything or give anything up or be anything that's for my hurt. It's all for my blessing and for my happiness and for my joy. So it's far better, is it not, to follow and to be obedient to what he has committed to us. God, give us grace and enable us to be wise and learn and walk in these ways. This is the way of true happiness, true peace, and true fruitfulness.